Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 24th, 1995. In the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is Walter Bowman, and he will be speaking on Introduction to Theology, C.S. Lewis. Let's listen in on Walter.
My name is Walt Bowman, and this is a session on C.S. Lewis. I think this whole week I just called a kind of Introduction to Theology. C.S. Lewis used to be really big at Holden. When I first came here in 1967, there were sessions on Lewis, and we did readings in the afternoon. Usually readings from The Great Divorce, because it's so readable from. There's still a shelf in the bookstore with C.S. Lewis books on it. Not many, however. I noticed over there there's A Grief Observed, which he wrote. Actually, it was part of the diary that he kept in thinking about his own grief when his wife, Helen Joy, died in 1960. And Mere Christianity is there, but I don't think we have any copies of The Great Divorce, which is truly sad. And Lewis has suddenly come into some popularity again with the movie Shadowlands. How many of you saw the movie? Oh, yes. I remember going to the Bexley Theater just across the street from the seminary and seeing lines of people. Jan and I were going to see the movie, and here there were people lined up to see this essentially tragic story of a man who deals with the death of his wife theologically. And what people were doing was, in a sense, going to a movie that was, if not overtly theological, then at least philosophical, paying money. It was like going to Stratford for the Shakespeare Festival in Ontario and finding people paying $50 a seat to go to T.S. Eliot's Murder in the Cathedral, which is essentially a great sermon. And I thought, we aren't charging enough. You know, we ought to charge people for preaching. The television play in which Claire Bloom starred was actually more faithful. I don't know why the movie took some of the liberties that it did, but there's no reason why there had to be only one son. Joy Davidman had two sons, and one could quibble about things like that, but essentially, the movie was somewhat unfair to Lewis himself. The problem of pain is not some theoretician sitting in an ivory tower and worrying about the issue of evil. Lewis is nonstop trying to make a case for Christianity, and he does that in The Problem of Pain just as he does it in all of his other books. So they're a little unfair, quite a bit unfair maybe, when they take a snippet out of The Problem of Pain and present it as some sort of Oxford intellectual giving a lecture, only then to bump into reality when he falls in love with a woman who is dying of cancer. It's more complicated than that. And what I want to do in part is to try to give you a little bit of Lewis's life before we look at some of his major ideas. Lewis was born in Belfast in Northern Ireland on the 29th of November, 1898. He lived almost 65 years. He died on the 22nd of November, 1963. It's the same day that John Kennedy was assassinated, and Aldous Huxley died on the same day. So three very, very significant deaths. He was the second of two sons. His elder brother Warren, or Warney, as he called him, was born in 1895. They remained the closest of friends, lived together for many years. His brother Warren also outlived him by a decade, died in 1973. Lewis was named Clive Staples, but when he was 6 years old, he simply announced that his name was Jaxie, shortened to Jack, and was never responded to anything else after that. So people had to call him Jack if they wanted an answer. His mother died when he was 10 in 1908 of cancer. It was a deeply traumatic event for both the boys, but above all for his father, who, Lewis says, was never the same after that. And as a result of his mother's death, he was sent off to boarding school. Well, he would have been sent off anyway. His brother was already at boarding school. It's what you did in those days. You sent your children off to boarding school. He went first to a place called Wynyard, where the headmaster was a certified psychotic, and the school was closed in 1910 when the headmaster was institutionalized. Lewis hated it. His father then kept him near home and sent him to a local Belfast school for about a year, but in 1911 he ended up at Malvern College, where he lost his faith. He said he made his first communion in utter unbelief. But there he also, in 1912, discovered Wagner. He bought recordings. You must imagine what these recordings were like, you know, 78's imperfect reproduction. But he had a lifelong love of Richard Wagner's operas, and especially The Ring of the Nibelungen, the great tetralogy that Wagner composed, because it evoked in him what he called an experience of northernness. And for him, northernness was purity, clarity, everything that draws us on and lays a grip, a hold on us. And recently, when the Metropolitan Opera did The Ring, Father Owen Lee, who was has a brilliant commentary on Wagner's Ring cycle, begins and ends the whole of his lectures by quoting Lewis's own description of his feelings as he encounters this marvelously evocative music. I first encountered Lewis when I was in seminary in 1950. I first saw The Ring in Bayreuth in 1956, and I wish I had known as much about Lewis in 1956 as I know now. It would have been, I think, an entirely different way to encounter these operas. He stayed at Malvern College until 1914. He was now a 16-year-old young man, and his father sent him to prepare for his university entrance exams to a man who influenced Lewis all his life, a man whom Lewis called the Great Knock, W.T. Kirkpatrick, who accepted only a very limited number of people to tutor, and he accepted C.S. Lewis at Bookham in Surrey in September of 1914. And it's interesting to hear Lewis's account of that. For as they were walking from the train station to Kirkpatrick's home, Lewis tried to make small talk, that the countryside of Surrey was more interesting than he had thought it would be, whereupon Kirkpatrick immediately pounced upon him and said, "What do you mean by interesting? And what right have you to say that it was interesting? What kind of expectations did you have of this countryside anyway? And what right did you have to have those expectations?" Lewis was just simply bowled over by this. But it goes something like this. He said, "The general banalities and small talk of most people simply did not enter into W.T. Kirkpatrick's expectations. The most casual remark was taken as a summons to a disputation. to a mere torrent of verbiage, he would cry, "Stop!" Not from impatience, but because it was offending his sense of meaning. More sensible observations might simply be interrupted by "excuse," ushering in a parenthetical comment. Full approval would be encouraged by "I hear you," but then usually followed by a refutation. Had I read this? Had I studied that? Had I any statistical evidence? And so to the inevitable conclusion, "Do you not see that you had no right to say what it was that you were saying?" Some boys, says Lewis, would not have liked it. To me, it was red beef and strong beer. Can I mention those two at home? The great Knock was his teacher, and he lived with him for 2 years, 2.5 years actually. They started immediately reading Homer, and Lewis loved it. He had, of course, learned modest Greek and Latin at Malvern College, but now plunged directly into Homer. He began to be drawn into the marvelous life of the Greek world and the Homeric epics. In 1917, he was awarded a place at University College in Oxford. And although he failed the entrance examinations because he could never do mathematics, it just eluded him forever. I don't quite remember how he referred to it, but algebra, he just thought, was a kind of sinister enemy of all learning. But he was admitted to Oxford in any event and immediately began a university career. Oxford and Cambridge terms are 10 weeks long. There are, I think, three in the course of a year. And I was just in Cambridge in April at the beginning of term on Saturday. The vergers were standing at the gates to all the colleges in their vestments and their academic regalia, admitting students and parents, cars all over the place coming in. My own former student who's doing graduate work at Cambridge now had a little pass that got us past these impressive people and into the various colleges so that we could look around a little bit. But it's a marvelous environment. It just exudes learning and, of course, tradition. At Clare College, where our former student is doing graduate work, only the seniors are allowed to walk across the grass. Any underclassmen who walk on the grass in the college quads are simply sent down. I mean, which means you're expelled. So he started in 1917 in April. In June, he was drafted. And now his best friend in the military, Patrick Moore, introduced him to his mother, Patrick's mother, with some interesting relationships. Lewis and Moore promised to look after each other's parents if either was killed. Moore was, in fact, killed. Lewis took it upon himself to have a lifelong obligation to Mrs. Moore. Some more malicious deconstructionist biographers have suggested that the relationship was not maternal filial, that it was in fact a sexual relationship. Lewis is very reticent about this in his own biography, Surprised by Joy. The best current biography, I've forgotten the author, I've read it, it's simply called Jack, and it's excellent. It's truly an excellent piece of work, suggests that Lewis probably had a kind of late adolescent crush on a middle-aged woman, that it never became an affair, and that it was transformed into a true sort of surrogate son-mother relationship. He went to France in November of 1917, and in the spring of 1918, the German armies, freed of any involvement in the Soviet Union, or that wasn't the Soviet Union then, in Russia, by the peace of Brest-Litovsk, sent hundreds of thousands of troops to the west, and Ludendorff tried to break the British and the French lines, nearly succeeded in doing this. Lewis was wounded on the 15th of April, 1918, was returned to England in May, and never went back into conflict. He returned to Oxford in 1919 with Mrs. Moore and her daughter Maureen in tow, and lived with them, or they with him, actually, until Mrs. Moore's death. He finished Oxford brilliantly in 1922, finished his undergraduate work, and immediately began graduate work. I'm not going to go into many of the details of his career at this point. I think it's sufficient to say that in 1925, he was appointed fellow and tutor at Magdalen College in Oxford, where he stayed until near the end of his academic career. There is now, I think, sufficient evidence that he ought to have been given a professorship in English at Oxford, did not receive one because of his being an outspoken Christian. And finally, Cambridge created a special professorship for him in Renaissance literature. He was and remains one of the outstanding authorities. One often forgets this when you look at all his Christian writings, but he was one of the outstanding authorities on medieval and Renaissance English literature, and his books on that subject are still standard for people who study the field. Greg, my son, who is writing a dissertation on Shakespeare, first learned of Lewis when we read the Narnia tales to him, and then was surprised to discover in his academic field that Lewis is the textbook, you see, in Renaissance literature. Cambridge created a professorship for him, and he commuted from his home in Oxford to Cambridge, lived at Magdalen College in Cambridge when he was in term, and taught there until nearly his last year, when he was in such poor health that he was not able to continue teaching. He, however, at Oxford, as an academic now, came in touch with people who took Christianity seriously, people whose intellect he respected, and so he couldn't just simply write them off as romantic or as unintelligent. And gradually he himself began to argue his way into some sort of belief. He describes his own conversion, not yet to Christianity, but to the possibility of God in this way. He said, "That which I greatly feared had at last come upon me. In the Trinity term of 1929, I gave in and admitted that God was God, and I knelt and prayed. Perhaps that night the most dejected and reluctant convert in all England. I did not then see what is now the most shining and obvious thing, the divine humility which will accept a convert even on such terms. The divine humility, the prodigal son at least walked home on his own feet, but who can duly adore that love which will open the high gates to a prodigal who is brought in kicking, struggling, resentful, darting his eyes in every direction for a chance of escape. The words compelle intrare, compel them to come in, Latin, compel them to come in, have been so abused by wicked men that we shudder at them, but properly understood they plumb the depth of the divine mercy. The hardness of God is kinder than the softness of men, and his compulsion is our liberation." It took another 2 years for Lewis to experience what he called a conversion to Christianity, and it happened in a quite ordinary way. He writes about that in this way. He says, "My brother Warney and I went to the zoo one afternoon. When we set out, I did not believe that Jesus is the Son of God, and when we reached the zoo, I did. Yet I had not exactly spent the journey in thought, not even in any great emotion. Emotional is perhaps, in fact, the last word that we can apply to some of the most important events in our lives. It was more like when a man, after a long sleep, still lying motionless in bed, becomes gradually aware that he is now awake. Interesting description of his conversion. From that moment on, Lewis became a tireless apologete. Apology means, for most of us, that we say we're sorry about something, and we go to someone and apologize for what we have done or said or how we have acted or whatever. But in theological terms, apologia means a reasoned defense. So when Cardinal Henry Newman wrote his own biography, he called it apologia pro vita sua, a defense of my own life, or in fact, in the title of his own life. Lewis became that kind of an apologete, one who spent his life then in two worlds, one in the academic world, where he was an outstanding scholar, and the other in the theological world, where he was an outstanding apologete, although he never studied theology formally. And his books are still in print in the millions and millions of copies, and it's to those that we want to turn in just a moment. His first significant book as a Christian apologete was The Pilgrim's Regress, a kind of rewriting of Bunyan's The Pilgrim's Progress, and it's a fairly nasty book, written with all the arrogance of a new convert who finally got it all figured out and who's writing to those dummies who still haven't seen the light. Then he wrote his Great Space Trilogy, Out of the Silent Planet, Paralandra, and That Hideous Strength, again sort of attacking university opponents of Christianity. There may have been some reason why Lewis failed of a professorship at Oxford, because he certainly didn't spare anybody. And in 1940, wrote the book, or published the book, The Problem of Pain, in which he tries to do away with the argument that evil, that suffering and evil in the world are reasons not to believe in God. And he does a brilliant thing in this book. He turns the argument on its head. He says, in fact, if there were not God, then we would not even be able to call something evil. See, because evil and good can exist only where there is a kind of standard. It's in fact Aristotle's and Thomas's Aquinas, sort of classical argument, or at least one of the classical arguments for the existence of God. You see, because we can only call something good and not just inconvenient if there is a standard by which we can measure some things as good and other things as evil. And it is the standard that Lewis says is really what we mean when we are talking about God. See, otherwise, Hitler's ability to crush the Jews cannot be called evil. One can only say, poor Jews, they just got the worst of it. Hitler had the power, he did it. What is the Wizard of Id's golden rule? He who has the gold has the rule. That can only be said if there is no final standard by which we can measure some things as good and some things as evil. Then, in 1941, he was asked to give the celebrated broadcast talks, which resulted in the book Mere Christianity. Lewis made the journey from Oxford to London to give these talks. They were immensely successful, that is, at least they were popular, and the BBC then asked him to do another set of talks on the Trinity. The first one was sort of He entitled the talks Right and Wrong as a Clue to Meaning in the Universe, and they were eventually published as The Case for Christianity. Then he was asked to give a second series on the doctrine of the Trinity, which he published as Beyond Personality, and finally in 1942 a third series called Christian Behavior. The three of these, Right and Wrong, Beyond Personality, and Christian Behavior, then eventually were published as Mere Christianity, still in print, still a very, very good read. In 1942, he also published Screwtape Letters, the Screwtape Letters, one of the most charming books ever written, in which you look at Christianity from the other side, because these are letters written by a senior devil in hell to a young nephew, Wormwood, who is sent to be the tempter for a man who is converted to Christianity. And that conversion, of course, is a defeat for Wormwood. And now Screwtape gives him all kinds of advice as to how to retrieve some benefit from his becoming Christian. For example, he goes to church for the first time and he sees people there whom he doesn't like. And now you could play on this, see. Lewis himself hated organ music, absolutely hated organ music, forced himself to go to church even though this dreadful organ music was dinning in his ears, hated hymns, hated to sing, but he made himself go to church because it was what Christians did, and made himself to go even though he didn't like a lot of the people that were there. He was a lifelong, very faithful attender at his parish church, which was in Headington Quarry, a suburb of Oxford. In 1952, he first began publishing the Narnia stories, which caught on immediately, and in 1955 published his autobiography, Surprised by Joy. He had by this time met Joy Davidman Gresham, whom he eventually married, but he finished his manuscript for his autobiography in 1948, before he knew her. So there is no attempt here at a kind of play on words. The story of their courtship is interesting. She started out as the pursuer, and Lewis holding her at arm's length, but eventually in 1956 she was about to be deported from England, and Lewis prevented that by entering into a civil ceremony with her. She was already dying of cancer, and in a hospital then in 1957 he entered into a sacramental marriage in the Church of England, that is with a priest performing the ceremony, and her recovery began. She had a remission then from sometime in 1957 until late 1959, and they went to Greece. His only other excursions outside of England were his childhood trip in 1907 to France, and then his military service. One can hardly call that travel. But he went to Greece, had a wonderful time with his wife, and then nursed her in her final illness in a tender way, and writes about this in the book A Grief Observed, which still remains for me one of the most moving and touching accounts of death. And it's not, or of the dying of a loved one. It is not a despairing book, although Lewis writes of his own grief and with enormous intensity. He himself was already in failing health, and but I want to do two things. I want to read the epitaph that he wrote for her. There is in the parish church simply a little plaque in the entrance that reads, "Here the whole world, stars, water, air, and field and forest, as they were reflected in a single mind, like cast-off clothes." behind, in ashes, yet with hope that she, reborn from holy poverty in Lenten lands, hereafter may resume them on her Easter day. It's a marvelous epitaph. Lewis himself died quietly on the afternoon of the 22nd. His brother Warney writes about it and says this, at 4 o'clock I took him his tea and had a few words with him, finding him thick in his speech, very drowsy, but calm and cheerful. It was the last time we spoke. At 5:30, I heard a crash in his bedroom. Running in, I found him lying unconscious at the foot of his bed. He ceased to breathe some 3 minutes later, and the following Friday would have been his 65th birthday. He's buried in the churchyard of Headington Quarry Parish Church with a simple cement slab over his grave that says, in a quote from Shakespeare's King Lear, "We must endure our going hence." marvelous. Well, now, what are his ideas? That's what we need to spend some time on. I have to say, just personally, I've been to Headington Quarry. I've been to that graveyard. I've seen the church. I've seen his grave. We were in Oxford one afternoon. We'd come to Oxford from Stratford and parked the car where we could and gone into the nearest pub for lunch, and I had my guidebook out and I said, now we have to go look for the Eagle and Child, which was the pub where Lewis ate with the Inklings every Tuesday. So we went out of the pub, started looking up and down the street, and Jan turned around and said, I think that's the pub. We were just in it. So we rushed back in and said, show us where the Inklings met, and they'll show you where these people sat for their pub lunches at noon and argued with each other. The only woman they ever admitted to this group was Dorothy Sayers, and she was not really a member of the group, but they respected her a lot, and so they let her sit with them once in a while. But it was J.R.R. Tolkien who wrote Lord of the Rings, right, and the Hobbit stories, and Colin Hardy and Owen Barfield and Gervase Matthews, who was a Dominican priest, and a wonderful group of people, Lewis and his brother. But I first encountered Lewis when I was a beginning seminarian, my first year in seminary. I had Yaroslav Pelikan as a teacher, and Pelikan destroyed the scholastic faith or theology that I had grown up with in the Missouri Synod. Scholastic, probably the word coming out of, or the term referring to the 17th century Lutheran dogmatic teachers on the basis of whom the little catechism was written that I studied as a child. And the essence of scholastic theology is that it establishes the authority of the Bible and then simply teaches everything in Christianity as coming from the Bible. And you believed it because it was in the Bible. What Pelikan did for all of us, I think, was to simply demolish that kind of what I would now call an authoritarian way of being a Christian, where your primary loyalty is not to the teaching itself, but to the authority from which it comes. I had a similar kind of experience when I first had to teach at a Catholic college. I was sharing this with Robin Henry yesterday afternoon. I went to Rosary College to teach courses there, especially to young women who were totally opposed to taking one more course from a priest or a nun, so they would flock to some Lutheran, anybody. except that my authorities didn't work. You know, I mean, I could say to them, Luther says, and they'd stare at me blankly, or the Lutheran confessions teach, and eyes would glaze over. And I learned there once again what I first learned from C.S. Lewis, that you have to teach things that are intrinsically true, that can stand on their own feet, no matter what authorities there are. Well, my world came crashing down when the authority of the Bible wasn't believable anymore for me, and I had nothing to replace it. This happened to a lot of my classmates. Some of them left seminary in anger at Christianity. I still, one of my dearest friend from high school and college years is a psychiatrist now in Los Angeles and writes regularly how he enjoys Sunday morning, sleeping in bed, not going to liturgies. He hates Christianity with a total passion. But he reads Paul Tillich. We'll talk about him tomorrow. And there's some hope that we may be able to communicate yet. But I, fortunately, along with some others of my classmates, stumbled on C.S. Lewis's Case for Christianity, or Mere Christianity. And I read this book, and it was astonishing that someone could argue the truth of Christianity without a single reference to the Bible. I was listening to a first-rate mind who grounded his approach to Christianity in argument. I don't mean in a quarrel, right? But who grounded it in argument rather than in authority. This was an astonishing new thing for me. I was 21 years old, and it changed my life. It just literally changed my life. Lewis was sincerely interested in truth, not in ideology. And for the first time in my life, that became a distinction. You see, I mean, ideology is a set of ideas that doesn't always have any relationship to reality, but which grabs you and controls you, and you will fight to defend the ideology. Truth is a subtler and different kind of passion, but nevertheless, it's very difficult to make a case for anything like truth in the United States today. We more or less think that religion is something, A, that you don't talk about, and B, if you do, it's more like show and tell. I'll show you mine, and then I'll listen politely while you show me yours. And as Gilbert and Sullivan had one of their characters say in the Mikado, "You are right, and I am right, and we are both as right can be." And so the main thing we don't want to do is argue with each other. And the consequence of all of this, I think, is what the people from the Lilly Foundation, who did a study for the Presbyterian Church, called lay liberalism. See, we like it that way. We select our churches not because they are true, but because we sort of like them. The minister is nice, the program is good, they have wonderful places for our kids. It's sort of like the Charlie Brown cartoon, in which Charlie and Linus are sitting in the sandbox, and Linus says, "Oh, I met this wonderful girl. She's so lovely. I met her in Sunday school. She's so lovely. I follow her around all the time." And then the final picture, the second last picture is, "But she just changed churches." And Charlie Brown's comment is, "That'll change your theology in a hurry." Well, what Schultz is saying here is that our reasons for belonging to churches basically have nothing to do with the intrinsic truth of what is going on there. We're quite content not to be argued into believing. And what Hoag and others discovered, however, is that the churches, that the people who remain Christian are the ones who have really, in a sense, gone through the process of arguing themselves into whatever it is, whatever convictions they now have. Well, that's what Lewis is about. He is trying to make a case for the faith. And what is that case? I'm back to problem of pain again. He says, right and wrong is the clue. We may not agree on what the content of that right or wrong is, but most of us, he would argue, in the end, all of us, have some sense of what is fair or when we are being dealt with unfairly. And he says that very notion of fairness, somebody pushes me out of my place in line and I say that's not fair, or somebody cheats me economically and I say that's not fair. He says the very notion that some things are fair and some things are not, that's the clue to what he calls the law of human nature. Not the laws of nature, but the law of human nature. We all have some sense of how we ought to behave, even if the ought for the mafia is never squeal to the law. Let's say the ought for a child in grade school is, if I catch you doing something that is wrong, I will go to the teacher and tell it. Quite a different ought from the mafia. But both of us believe that there is a kind of ought, and secondly, that we don't always live up to it. You see, we are the one law which is there, which says you ought to behave in a certain way, is also the one that we are all able to break. That, he says, leads us to something that is more than instinct. And here he says you might think love of humanity in general is a safe way to be in the world. But if you leave out justice, you will find yourself breaking agreements and faking evidence in trials for the sake of humanity and become in the end a cruel and treacherous person. Lewis's observations are just often very astute. Love without truth is bound to be cruel, but truth without love is bound to be cruel. But love without truth is also bound to betray us in numerous ways. He argues further that because we have this sense of ought and can't always live up to it, the one place where it's likely to show up, the one place where we are able to really be able to get a clue of the universe is within ourselves. And what we find there is a yes to this notion of a moral law. That leads us then to the conclusion that there is a controlling power outside of the universe which has planted clues to its existence within us, that is, within our own conscience. Conscience here does not mean the ability to distinguish actual right from actual wrong, but merely the notion that there is an ought at all. It's the necessity to justify ourselves, to claim that we are in the right in a quarrel and that the other is in the wrong. That, he says, is the clue to this controlling power. But he concludes all of this by saying, if he's right, then we have cause to be uneasy. He ends by saying, what I have to say to you is not very comfortable. And you could accuse me of saying that Christianity ought to be comforting. I quite agree that the Christian religion is in the long run a thing of unspeakable comfort, but it does not begin in comfort. It begins in dismay, and it is no use at all to go on to the comfort without first going through the dismay. In religion, as in war and everything else, comfort is the one thing you cannot get by looking for it. If you look for truth, you may get comfort in the end. But if you look for comfort, you will get neither comfort nor truth, only soft soap and wishful thinking to begin with, and in the end, despair. Most of us have got over that pre-war wishful thinking in international politics. It's time we did the same in religion. Now, notice he has not yet gotten to Christianity. He has simply said, all I've said is that there is something which is going to be able to hold us to account for an ought which we disobey. And therefore, he says, to encounter God, and above all, God's goodness, is not going to be comforting at all. In A Grief Observed, he says, people who say that God is good have never been to the dentist. No, I'm sorry, it's a little bit more complicated. People who are comforted by the notion that God is good have never been to the dentist. He says God's goodness is anything but comforting. And then he stops. He breaks off at that point. He does not then say, now I can argue you from that into Christianity. And it's in a sense somewhat similar to Lewis's own path to conversion. Lewis argues himself reluctantly, kicking and screaming, he says, into believing there is God. That's not the same thing as being Christian. And I think it's a very important distinction for Lewis to make this. I always keep worrying, you see, that we use the word God so glibly in the United States, as if then we were already thinking Christianity. Not so. As Dwight Eisenhower says, America is built on a firmly felt religious faith, and I don't care what it is. Which may or may not be true, but the caring what it is in fact what gets us finally to Christianity. What Lewis does with the second half of his case for Christianity is to start over again. You cannot move from this dismay, this encounter with the goodness of God, which holds us to account and which is, in a sense, inexorable in dealing with us. You can't move from that to Christianity. You have to start over, because Christianity has a different basis. It is grounded in the historical event of Jesus. And Lewis writes about this movingly, with great truth. He says, I'm not arguing for a particular religious tradition. He says, I can only sort of take you into the hallway. What room you go into, he means Methodist or Presbyterian or Lutheran or Anglican or Roman Catholic. What room you go into, that's another matter. But I will at least get you into the hallway. And he says, not even the most difficult divisions between the various rooms is as important as the division between Christianity and everything else. Because Christianity is grounded on the conviction that Jesus is the Christ, that the Messianic age has come, that the kingdom of God is in fact here. That's what distinguishes Christianity from everything else. Now, a couple of other things yet. Lewis, and I want to say this as a kind of summary, Lewis is a supernaturalist in the classical sense. He believes that there are two supernatural powers. He believes in a real devil and a real supernatural, that is outside of nature, God. These two powers are in conflict. He believes there is a real hell and a real heaven, and that the conflict between them is a conflict for our eternal destiny. He puts all of that into expression in The Great Divorce, a book I love to read in segments, because each of the chapters takes up a kind of different topic, and they can be read as dialogues, and then you can have a go at it. The fifth chapter issue for Lewis, in which a friend, the premise for The Great Divorce is that people come from a gray town on a bus trip, which lands them in a bright world, where they suddenly discover as they get off the bus that they can see through themselves, and that the grass they are walking on hurts their feet terribly because it is hard. And what he is saying is that hell is living with illusions, and heaven is like living with reality itself. But if you have spent your life living with illusions, then confronting the truth is like walking on grass which hurts your feet terribly, and the illusion is that you can suddenly see through yourself. Well, anyway, a bright spirit meets someone wearing gaiters. This is the traditional dress of Anglican clergy. You button up the pants leg, and it fits tight. Must have been before designer jeans. "My dear boy, I'm delighted to you, delighted to see you," says the clergy person to the bright spirit. Then they go on. Dick, I shall never forget some of our talks. I expect you've changed your views now. You became rather narrow-minded toward the end of your life, but no doubt you've broadened out again." "How do you mean?" says the bright spirit. "Well, it's obvious by now, isn't it, that you weren't quite right? Why, my dear boy, you believed in a literal heaven and hell." "But wasn't I right?" "Oh, in a spiritual sense, perhaps. I still believe in them that way. I am still, my dear boy, looking for the kingdom, but nothing superstitious." "Excuse me," says the bright spirit, "where do you imagine you've been?" "Ah, I see," says the clergyman. "You think that gray town with its continual hope of morning, with its field for indefinite progress, is in a sense heaven, if only we have eyes to see it. What a beautiful idea." "I didn't mean that at all," said the bright spirit. "Is it possible you don't know where you've been?" "Oh, now that you mention it, I don't think we ever do give it a name. What do you call it?" "We call it hell." "There's no need to be profane, my dear boy. I may not be very orthodox in your sense of the word, but I do feel that in these matters we ought to discuss seriously and reverently." "Discuss hell reverently? I meant what I said. You've been in hell, though if you don't go back, you may call it purgatory." "Oh, go on, my dear boy, go on. This is so likely. No doubt you'll soon tell me why, on your view, I was sent there." "Don't you know? You went there because you're an apostate." "Are you serious, Dick?" "Perfectly." This is worse than I expected. Well, I'm not going to read the whole dialogue. But what they go on then is to have an argument over whether there is such a thing as truth, whether you can really be in the wrong. Lewis believed this all his life, wrote his books out of that. You can see the conflict between good and evil powers in the Narnia stories for children, in The Great Divorce, in the Screwtape Letters, in the problem of pain, everywhere. It's sort of the great theme of his life. Tomorrow, what I want to do is to take a theologian who's not a supernaturalist, who in fact spent all of his life sort of against supernaturalism, but who comes out in a lot of the same places that Lewis does, namely Paul Tillich. Today, however, we've got some minutes left when we can just enjoy Lewis and talk about him. Any questions that you might have or comments? Back there.
You mentioned that he had some interesting journey in terms of confronting the idea of the Trinity. Where does he really go with that? And are we perhaps to be instructed by that in some way?
With the Trinity?
I read Stendhal's book on Romans, and I thought that puts a little different twist to it.
You read what on Romans?
Christopher Stendhal just did a little one, the final account. So.
Uh-huh. And do you think, what are you trying to say?
I'm not trying to disperse with the Trinity, but the essentialness of the Trinity seems to be at least somewhat ameliorated. He says that it's really, in Stendhal's concept as I see it, that the mission of Paul to the Gentile world was not to introduce him to the Trinity, but this is the kind of God. And Jesus becomes part of it, of course. But this is the way God acts. Not, legalism and all those sorts of things. It's a theology for his mission when
right,
he goes to Rome.
Right, yes.
And I just wonder if there's some affinities that we hold almost too dearly. You know, you really got to confess the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit. That maybe Lewis gives us some entree.
I think Lewis, however, Lewis would want to say that the Trinity is essential to being Christians.
I'm not sure that Stendhal says no to that either.
Quite possibly. But what Stendhal is doing is saying that the eventual doctrine of the Trinity is not to be found in so many words in the New Testament, in the writings of the New Testament. And I think that's fundamentally true. What you have in the New Testament are the random writings of a movement within Judaism that took the Jewishness of God seriously. What has to be said is that in the writings of Paul already, and surely in Romans, there is a very high view of Jesus. And I want to stress this more tomorrow, namely that Jesus is the last word. And because of that, then, they were required to re-envision the very meaning of God, and eventually concluded from looking at the cross that God must at least be confessed as Father and Son. And if the kingdom of God has come, then God has to be confessed as Father, Son, Spirit, because Spirit belongs essentially to the coming of the New Age. Lewis does not get at the doctrine of the Trinity in that way. Lewis asks different kinds of questions. He is not asking, how did we get historically to this point? He is asking, is there any meaning in it? And so he talks about the three-personed God as a way in which one can... His basic argument is, reality is always more difficult than anything else. He says, if you want an invented religion, it'll be simple. But reality is always very complicated. To hit this rock is to hit something solid, but a scientist would tell us that there's a lot of particles and ion and empty space. And so he says, reality, the real God, is more complicated than anything we could invent. That's Lewis's line of approach. Those are two different ways, one historical, one theoretical, I suppose I would call it. And Stendhal is, of course, a historian, whereas Lewis is a theoretician. Matt?
I was just going to say that, because I was thinking, oh yeah. But, and then he also argues pretty well for Jesus' authority, and says that,
yes,
as far as Jesus is part of the Trinity. I just wanted to add that you can still buy tapes of C.S. Lewis speaking, giving his talks.
Broadcast talks.
The Four Loves.
Yes.
And you can go to bookstores and get this, and it's really interesting to get it and listen to him talk. He sounds very, like an Oxford Don. But if you ever go to an audio or bookstore, that kind, look for that. And also, the Screwtape letters have just come out in comic book form. Kind of interesting.
I did not know that.
So, look for that too.
Brad.
Screwtape letters are also available as read by John Cleese of Monty Python.
Oh.
And he's got it. I mean, he really understands Lewis's point of view, and it's beautifully nuanced in a way that if either you get it or you don't, he's clearly got it. I've assigned that to students instead of reading the book. Sometimes it's given the option of listening to the tape, and what I've assigned them to do is write a letter to their own tempter to see if they've got themselves figured out at any significant level of what will seduce them to be unfaithful in ministry. And I've tried to say to them, don't even try to compete with Lewis's style, because that's he can't, and I just want to see if you get the point. What I in fact find is many of them can do it really well. Once they get into that mindset, they can pick up on Lewis's style and really brilliantly funny stuff. It's the best assignment I give. It's the most fun to do.
It's interesting. Lewis said he had a hard time writing that because he hated getting into that mindset. It made him all itchy.
Yeah, I don't believe that. I think he loved every minute. I know he said that. I don't think that's true.
The one comment I wanted to make is that these things read well because the Inklings, what this group did was to read book manuscripts to each other. So Lewis read his stuff to the others and then got critique on it. They gathered on Thursday evenings to do